It's WKXL in the morning at 1450 AM, 103.9 FM, and nhtalkradio.com. I'm AJ Kierstead. Let's get the latest in New Hampshire government news with our friends at the New Hampshire Bulletin. Get their latest articles at newhampshirebulletin.com. They join WKXL in the morning every Friday. I'm joined by reporter Amanda Gokey. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Today, Friday, you're going to be releasing a new article on the Executive Council providing funding for farmer mental health. I'd love to dive into what that looks like.
Yeah, for sure. So this is a new program. It's made available through some of the COVID relief money. It's $500,000 that the Executive Council approved to receive that money. And basically what it's going to go towards is supporting farmers' mental health. So farmers actually have a pretty broad array of specific concerns. And those have to do with things like the family farm dynamic. They're working in an industry where their margins are actually usually really small. So I learned that they can be anywhere from 3% to, in a really great good case, they could be as high as 10%. But what that means is a couple of wrong decisions and people can find themselves losing their farms. And particularly in the dairy industry, COVID really wreaked a lot of havoc. So there were a lot of farm closures, and this kind of continues a trend of just the industry struggling. So even in the past 2 years, it's gone from about 120 dairy farms in the state to, I think, just over 85. Right now. So what this funding would do through the cooperative extension is they're looking at doing four things. The first is that they want to get the word out and sort of destigmatize mental health, because as you might imagine, for farmers, as for many people, it's not always easy to get help. So they want to get the word out there. They also want to have direct services. So for farmers to sort of cover the costs, if they want to see a therapist, if they want to talk to somebody about their taxes, they could do that. They could do other things as well, like get legal assistance if they're facing bankruptcy. So that's about $200,000 would go towards those direct services. And then they're also looking to put together a resource library so that they would pull together podcasts, articles. And then they're also going to do the sort of fourth area that they're going to be looking at is doing education. So it would be trainings on just various topics that are the main sort of stressors that they've identified.
Yeah, farmers are in a unique situation where they're basically a small business, even though they might employ hundreds of people throughout the year, but they're usually very small operations with like a family doing it. They don't have like the HR department to go to and say, hey, I'm stressed, what do I do? So this is an amazing idea, especially in the realm of COVID, where every supply chain, it's beyond, when you think global supply chain, you think things coming from China, you think things coming from South America. There are products that literally are grown or raised in the state that also had their supply chains messed up, either because of on-the-farm dynamics, transportation, so their businesses just suffered severely during this.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I remember hearing about maple syrup producers who are struggling with like bottle shortages and things, yeah, of that nature. Like they may have seen a huge increase in demand for some of the products, but weren't necessarily able to meet it because of what you were talking about with those supply chain issues. Another interesting sort of thing that came up in the reporting of this were, there was some skepticism about a program like this in terms of which populations it would actually go towards supporting, and particularly concerns about, you know, would it help some of the farm workers in addition to just focusing on some of the farm owners? So, you know, in the state, a lot of there's migrant farm workers that are supporting our agricultural industry here. You know, would they also be able to avail themselves of these sort of resources and opportunities? And you know, from covering that topic in the past, it can be things like language barriers. That can be a big one that would prevent some people from being able to, say, take advantage of an online library.
Is that still up in the air, what the line is that they're going to put on it?
So it sounds like the folks who are organizing this, it's kind of like the funding arm is coming through the State Department of Agriculture because of funding requirements, but the cooperative extension at UNH is actually going, they're sort of they've designed the program, and they are definitely taking into consideration sort of a diversity and equity lens to the work. So they have a queer farmer in the North country who's been sort of working on that already. They got some money last year, a smaller amount. It was $25,000 that they received to sort of start working on this issue of farmer mental health. So I know it's something that they're thinking about and trying to do it sort of as inclusive as they can. But, you know, on the flip side of that, I spoke with someone who works with New American farmers, and he was just mentioning, you know, oftentimes they haven't been included in sort of relief efforts throughout the pandemic. So I think that concern is still a little bit there.
Yeah, the farming community is, as we both have talked about this point, is you think of the people that own the farm. You don't necessarily think of all the people that actually are on the farm. They may work 2 or 3 months at a time, then they're off into the ether. They're not continuing to receive a paycheck anymore. They may move on to another farm, and they may have gigs elsewhere. I know musicians that are down in Tennessee or wherever during the winter months, and they come up here and work the farm during the summer. They play some gigs, they work during the day, so they're outside of the traditional employment ecosystem where a lot of the CARES Act funding and such would have covered them.
Yeah, definitely. That's an interesting point. And I think that it'll be, I'm curious to see how this sort of unfolds and who's able to take advantage of it.
So everyone should check out NewHampshireBulletin.com to check out that article when it goes live. Let's move on to another just confusing worldwide issue, Afghan resettlement. I actually recorded an interview with Emma Tobin of the, so they get the proper promotion of it, International Institute of New England, which will be on the New England Take either today or next week. I'm not sure when it's going to be airing exactly, but they're going to be assisting with 250 Afghan evacuees that are going to be going down to Massachusetts. But New Hampshire is also going to be on the docket for receiving up to a couple hundred. What did your article look like on that?
Yeah, so yesterday this was something that Governor Kristi Noem talked about, and basically it sounds like we'll be receiving between 100 and 200 Afghan refugees in New Hampshire. Sununu had talked on Tuesday with the Secretary of Homeland Security about some of the details around how this resettlement process is going to go. There were about 120,000 people evacuated from Kabul. That includes some people who are already US citizens, but it also includes women and children and other Afghan refugees. So they're flown to other countries. They aren't arriving directly to the United States. And in those other countries, they're sort of undergoing these, what sounded like pretty intensive screenings. So those included things like biometric screenings. They were even going to look at their electric devices and sort of see if they had any, what Sununu called questionable material on there. And then sort of after clearing that, they would arrive in the U.S. either to Dulles or Philadelphia. And then from there, there's about 8 military bases where these folks are going to be going to, and they'll get sort of immunizations, whether it's COVID or measles. I was reading there's apparently some sort of measles outbreaks. So those things would all sort of be taken care of before they actually arrive to New Hampshire. And so it sounds like the earliest they would be arriving is in a few weeks.
Yeah, I think the point that these individuals will be screened before they arrive is probably the most important thing to break through the political barriers people might have one way or another. What's really unique about the Afghan resettlement is it's an across the board left and right. Yes, we will take the people that are coming out of Afghanistan as long as they were screened. There's considerable veteran population that wants to make sure that they get resettled appropriately and they get the resources they need. There's anti-war activists that are also just as like, oh my God, please save these people and get them resources. So it's really amazing seeing the communities begin to come together on that. And I'm glad to hear that New Hampshire is kind of taking part in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, another important piece of this conversation is sort of once they arrive here and some of the issues that have been going on, as you mentioned, that sort of do cross the political spectrum. Obviously, in New Hampshire, there's sort of a housing crisis right now and a housing shortage. So that's another thing that I think people are thinking about in advance of these folks' arrival, and some creative sort of solutions have been put out there. But I think that will be another moment for people to think through that issue and how we are going to approach it in the state.
Yeah, it's going to be a tremendous hurdle. I mean, the market's a disaster right now. I mean, I was looking at like apartments and townhouses and such recently because I'm rich. And it's the rates have gone up like 50% at least on just basic things. So, like, I've got in my full-time job, a coworker of mine was looking to move from Massachusetts to New Hampshire, and the closest she could find was Nashua that was at a reasonable rate that allowed pets at all, because it's entirely a the market for the landlords right now to basically charge whatever they want because people are paying. So I'd imagine there's going to be a lot of concern over, A, they're not taking housing that other people are in desperate need of right now in the state, but also making sure that these Afghan immigrants are getting appropriate housing for families. Because like you said, a lot of them are going to be coming with their families. I mean, there's a reason why a lot of these interpreters were working with the government. It's because they wanted to improve the country, and unfortunately, it didn't exactly play out the way anyone wanted in Afghanistan.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be an interesting process again there. To your point, in terms of people looking for sort of creative solutions, I was and people having to travel just really far distances. I know in the Upper Valley, people were looking at places as far sort of away as Concord, which is like over an hour.
Wow.
So it really
that's
does.
A hell of a winter commute.
Yeah, those are roads in the winter would be pretty treacherous.
All right, you have written about a bit more. What would you like to jump on next?
So another thing that I've been watching and that came out of yesterday's executive council meeting was the new Department of Energy has sort of slowly sununu and has sort of slowly been filling the ranks of that new department.
What is that department when it comes to the state? Because that's just seems a little nuts to me that New Hampshire would have a dedicated department for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, it's supposed to be a central home, if you will, for energy policy in the state. And that work was kind of used to be done across several different departments, but there wasn't really a clear place where energy policy was created. So what it did is it brought together sort of parts of the Office of Strategic Initiatives. Supposedly it's called like administratively attached to the Public Utilities Commission. So
government.
The Public Utilities Commission just kind of like looks after all the business that utilities are doing and regulates that. But they're not really creating policy. They're supposed to be just kind of regulating what's happening. So that was the idea behind it. And kind of what's happened right now, it seems, is that they're having a hard time finding somebody to fill the sort of head top role, the commissioner position of that department. So it started back in July. That's when this new department sort of officially launched after it was created in the budget bill last legislative session. And they had an interim commissioner, Jared Chicoine, who was previously the director of the Office of Strategic Initiatives. He was supposed to serve a 60-day interim period that came and went. And now he's been reappointed to that interim position. So they're still sort of looking for somebody permanently to take that role. But what I've been hearing is, you know, people who work in and around that department and outside experts have just said it's a hard position to fill. For some people in industry, it might mean taking a bit of a pay paycheck cut. And it's a pretty challenging job. So
it's going to be a job that's going to be fraught politically. I mean, the diversification of energy production in the state has been very politically motivated one way or another. There are a lot of businesses that have popped up, like Revision Energy and such, trying to push solar. But then there's protests about this one little coal producing electric plant that does like emergency sometimes 1% of energy a year. So it's people are very knee-jerk reactionary to it, and this person's gonna have to be ready to deal with some PR occasionally.
Yeah, and the other thing that's been really interesting in watching this, you know, one of the concerns I heard with the department when it was just first being proposed in the budget process was that adage, like, personnel is policy, right? And so Sununu has kind of stacked these positions with people who many of them are straight from his office. So I think for some Democrats watching this, that's kind of raised a flag of the governor using this office to get more influence over how energy policy is created.
Yeah, I mean, how does this position work? Is it made to be a long-term position? Is it a governor-to-governor appointment?
So when the permanent appointment is actually made, I believe the term for this is going to be 4 years. And the interim position obviously is much shorter than that. They've just the sort of Chicoine will be in that role now through the end of October. But that person will be a commissioner and they'll be heading up the department. One change that NHPR's Annie Ropeek reported on with this new department that was interesting to hear about is that the Public Utilities Commission, that's going to be a part of this new department now. It's supposed to be independent, but the chair is actually going to be answerable to the governor. So that's in some ways a significant change from how the Public Utilities Commission was set up before.
Yeah, I could see this position being, I guess continuing what I just said, is it's with that position being changed every 4 years, it'll make it past at least one election in between and being secure. But there could be a radical shift with regards to how it operates every other governor. So it's seems like mostly Sununu does a pretty good job with not going too radical in the activism side of the house. But if we get an activist governor in there at some point down the road, that could really influence what that department does, I'd imagine.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's possibly something we might see in the future. So it'll be an interesting one to watch.
Has this interim person done a whole lot specifically, or just kind of keeping the lights on?
I think it's more of the latter from the sense that I've gotten. I've reached out to see if I could speak with him about sort of his vision and goals for the time he's going to be in there. But the response I got was things are a little busy right now. And so I think just kind of getting things to a place where that transition is more smooth is what he's focused on.
That's and it's not to be point. Not to be missed the fact that the job market also affects people in government and executive level jobs. That's for sure. That it's not just restaurants looking for employees. It's people also in government. It's really hard to find candidates. Like the university has a hard time filling high up roles right now. The large companies are having a hard time finding people that want to come to New Hampshire, especially with, once again, the housing market is not ideal. So it's going to be really hard to find a place where you don't have to travel far away. So it'll be interesting to see how long it takes them to fill this role and if it's got to go into next year at some point.
Yeah, and the staffing sort of crisis and confusion is definitely something that came up in my reporting. The Office of the Consumer Advocate is also sort of now a part of this new Department of Energy, and he lost two of his main analysts. They were kind of taken by the Public Utilities Commission, so people are shifting around, and then the Public Utilities employees were moved over to the Department of Energy. So there's been kind of this big rearranging that just people have described a lot of confusion around how it's shaking out.
So, all right. Thank you, Amanda Gokey, for joining me today. Where can people check out your reporting?
So my reporting is up at thenewhampshirebulletin.com.
WKXL in the morning on 1450 AM, 103.9 FM, and nhtalkradio.com.